Okay, so I wanted to discuss, originally we were going to do three shiurim, we're only going to have time for two, so we're not going to be able to do everything. So I figured, since we're not going to be able to do everything, I wanted to take a little bit more of an outside approach, at least in the initial stage of Megillat Esther, to discuss Megillat Esther's nature and where it fits. We'll start with a couple of approaches to, the nature and fit of Megillat Esther. We take it for granted that Esther is part of Tanakh. We take all of Tanakh as being for granted. It's actually something, I didn't first get this, that there isn't like a universally accepted canon of Tanakh. The first time I eventually started taking Bible classes in graduate school, but before I realized that, there's actually a little bit of a funny way to realize this. Every time you go to a hotel, what's in the night table drawer by the left by the Dear Gideons? There's a Christian Bible. So it was when I was flipping through that for the first time that I noticed that there are actually, first of all, the order is different in the Christian Bible of the Old Testament, what they call the Old Testament, and there are actually some books in there that aren't in ours. That was what I guess ignited me for the first time of the idea that what belongs in Tanakh is contested. Now, in fact, this is a huge amount of scholarly literature about the canon of Tanakh, when it happened and and what was included at the time. The prevailing theme until about the 1970s, starting in Germany and when the Wissenschaft first was ignited, the prevailing theme was that at the beginning of the Bayit Sheni period, it's referred to in scholarly literature as the Council of Yamnia. Right, which is the Council of Yavne, which happened at the end of at the Bayit Sheni period, not the beginning, I'm sorry. So it was after the Churban Beit HaMikdash. We actually spoke about this last week. At the end of the Churban Beit HaMikdash, everybody, all the Tanaim met in Yavne, and they decided what was going to go in and what was going to go out. This theory was pretty much debunked in its entirety by Dr. Schneier Lyman in his doctoral thesis in the 1970s. And he argued with, I encourage you to look this theory up. I think the summary of it actually is in Wikipedia. So, kedai to take a look. But he basically, through a whole bunch of methods, debunked the theory and saying that it's impossible that it was that late. It had to have been several years earlier. So the prevailing theme now, proven by Dr. Lyman, is that it happened many centuries earlier before, towards the beginning of the Bayit Sheni period, and that was the period in which Nevuah ceased, in which we no longer had prophecy. And that was the time, and when you think about Tanakh as being a book of revelation, it actually makes sense that coincided with the closing of the canon. If that's the case, then the last few books chronologically in Tanakh present a very interesting question for us. Right? The last few books in Tanakh are going to be the books that tell of the Aliyah of Ezra and Nehemiah and of what was happening in the short Galut of Babel after the Churban Bayit Rishon, which is the historical period that we find ourselves in right now. Now, I say that as an introduction to our introduction because the point that I would like to go over with you right now is that the canonicity, right, the place of Megillat Esther in Tanakh is by far an obvious, clear thing. And I don't even say that from a scholarly perspective. I think even in Chazal, we get significant hints of the fact that Megillat Esther was not clearly, unquestionably, without a shadow of a doubt, belonging in Tanakh. And before we read the couple of Mamari Chazal that I collected, there's just one very fascinating tidbit. Right, what do we know about the Dead Sea Scrolls? Right? We know they were discovered. Fascinating story about how they were discovered. A couple of kids playing in a bunch of caves. They threw a rock. They heard a pottery shatter. This was in the 40s, I believe. Anybody help me out? I think it was originally in the 40s that this took place. A couple of kids were playing and they heard a rock shatter. They went in and they discovered it. And it turns out that there were these jugs, these giant jugs, over 2,000-year-old jugs, full of scrolls. And because the luck of fate, that this is a region of the world which was extremely dry and it allowed, it was the perfect conditions to sustain papers that, these papyrus rolls that otherwise would have disintegrated over this period of time. So we discovered all of this stuff. And it was an entire world of this sect of Jews that basically lived, they were sectarians, they kind of lived, they were rebelling against the mainstream Jewish community. And they took with them, Dead Sea Scrolls are fascinating. The first time, until the Dead Sea Scrolls came up, there was a large segment of academic literature that thought that the Bible was a product of the Middle Ages. Right? It was religious fanatics that wanted to justify their religion, and they started putting together all of these texts that really had no basis in history whatsoever. This, in one fell swoop, the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls upended an entire field, an entire approach to biblical criticism. Which is, I always thought as a, that little story was a really important lesson to scholars of all shapes and sizes of the importance of humility, of recognizing the possibility that you might be dead wrong in anything that you're proposing. Be that as it may, so the Dead Sea Scrolls found pieces of every single book of Tanakh. There's one exception. Can anybody guess what it is?
Esther
is the only book of Tanakh in which there is not a scrap of text in all the Dead Sea Scrolls. We're talking about huge amounts of text. These people were very, very into Tanakh. And there is not one line of Megillat Esther anywhere in the Dead Sea Scrolls. What do you think that means? That is a very heretical answer. But said it happened afterwards. Maybe it happened afterwards, Jerry, but I don't know if we can give you an Alien Shul anymore, if that's really what you mean. Can anybody give me a less heretical answer?
It was not part of Tanakh yet.
The one possibility is more like the people that were arguing before Dr. Wyman came and debunked them, and that maybe those scholars were right, and the Council of Yavne was the ones that set Tanakh, and it wasn't part of Tanakh yet. But
the sect did not accept.
Yeah, so and that's what Linda suggested. I think the most likely explanation for this, and if there was like five or six books of Tanakh missing, I wouldn't necessarily be able to make this claim. But considering what we know and what we're going to see even more about Megillat Esther, the fact that there's not a scrap of paper means that at this stage in history, which is several centuries after the story of Megillat Esther actually happened, at this stage in history, it was a hotly debated topic whether or not it belonged in Tanakh. And the zealots that lived in Qumran, right, the people that produced the Dead Sea Scroll documents, they were people that didn't believe that Megillat Esther belonged in Tanakh. Now, was this a widespread belief at the time? Was it, a scholarly debate, but it was ruled on, so therefore nobody really argued with it? We can't know for sure, but the fact this is a clear, this is a historical fact that we can live and breathe. We can touch these pieces of paper, and we know for a fact that the one book of Tanakh that they were not interested in was Megillat Esther. If that's the case, then I think that was just a really good tidbit of a historical fact as an introduction. Now let's get to what Chazal actually say. Source number one is a Gemara in Masechet Megillah. Tanu Rabbanan, 48 Nevi'im v'sheva Nevi'ot nitnabu lahem liYisrael. There were 48 Nevi'im and 7 Nevi'ot, 48 prophets and 7 prophetesses. V'lo pachatu v'lo hotiru al mash katu b'Torah. All of these 55 prophets didn't change what was written in the Torah at all. Chutz mimikra Megillah. Except for mikra Megillah. Okay, so what do you think this means? Setting up the point, and then it makes the point. All the 55 prophets that existed throughout Jewish history never changed Masha Katuv BaTorah, or they didn't add to Masha Katuv BaTorah. Chutz mimikra Megillah. So what do you think? What do you think the first point is, and what do you think? How is Megillat Esther an exception?
They didn't add a mitzvah.
Okay, so if that's true, right, so we're going to take the obligation to read Megillat Esther on Purim as the mitzvah derabanan. Is Mikra Megillah the only derabanan? There are other ones. Okay, so I mean, that Rashi says what you're saying. I mean, it's probably the simplest understanding of how to read this Gemara. The problem is that really is hard to take that at face value. It can't be that the Gemara is actually saying here that the Megillat Esther was the only mitzvah derabanan, the only mitzvah that Chazal ever introduced, or if not Chazal, then the Nevi'im introduced. So any other possibilities? Lohotiru amashkatuv b'Torah. They didn't add to what was written in the Torah. So if it's not a concrete mitzvah, what else could it mean?
The text itself.
Okay, so I think that's probably the more easier read of this Gemara. That what the Gemara is saying is that the Nevi'im didn't add anything to what's written in the Torah. Now, of course, there's an obvious question for that as well, which is,
the other books.
Yeah, exactly. There are other books of the Torah. There were five books of the Torah, and there was then several other books. There are 20, another 19 that were part of the Nach. And if that's the case, then Esther is not one of the five books of the Torah. It's one of the Tanakh, and there were many other books that Nevi'im didn't introduce.
Yeah, but Torah is a much wider word for describing the Tanakh.
So it could be that, but it's still a problem. I'm saying it's still a problem. No matter how you say it, I agree with you that that's how we'd have to read this Gemara. That when it says Torah, it's referring to Tanakh, not just the Torah. But if it's all of Tanakh, then the question stands.
Yeah.
How is it that we're only singling out Esther when there are so many other books of Tanakh? Elamai, yeah.
Esther's got a totally different level of, call it Nivuah or whatever.
Yeah. So I think that on a surface level, and again, I don't want to read this Gemara superficially, because the Rishonim debated, and this is the very issue that they're contending with. But I think that the easiest way, or at least the clearest way to read this Gemara, is to say like the second way that we said, that we're referring to scriptures right now, and we're not referring to mitzvot. And not only referring to scriptures, but I think that what the Gemara seems to be emphasizing here is that we're not talking about Nach, but we're actually talking literally, Tachi, like literally referring to the Torah. And if that's the case, this Gemara is making a huge statement about what Megillat Esther is. Which is what? If we're referring to not the mitzvot and not Nach, but actually Torah, what's it telling us about Megillat Esther?
It should have been in some opinion.
That according to this Gemara, it should have been in what?
In the Torah.
In the Torah. In the Chamishah Torah. If that's the case, if we're reading this Gemara correctly, then this Gemara is making a really wild statement. That Megillat Esther actually is so important that it belongs in the Torah itself. Not Nach, but the Torah itself. Anybody want to argue with me about how that's not the... I understand that itself comes with some really difficult problems. Yeah. Sorry? So how is it possible? It's an excellent question. Now the way to say this is that not that it actually, we want to add it as an appendix to Sefer Dvarim. That's not what I mean. But what I think this, if that's what this Gemara is saying, what it's saying is that there is a huge amount of significance to Megillat Esther. Ad kedei kach, that it is qualitatively different, even above and beyond the other books of the Nevi'im. That's what this Gemara would be saying. If that's what this Gemara means. Yeah. You're right. Okay, so which is why what led Rashi to the original, right, which to Linda's pshat, is that we're talking about the mitzvah. But that's a problem because there are lots of mitzvot. There's no. I'll emphasize again. I don't think my answer is problem free. There's obviously big problems, but there is no good answer to this question because this Gemara is full of problems.
Derived from Nach. I'm not saying mitzvot
derived from
Nach, but that are specifically delineated in Nach.
Lighting candles is not, I mean, you mean for Hanukkah. So the Hanukkah is actually a good, Rashi himself anticipates the question, and he says, because Rashi thinks that this is about a mitzvah, Rashi on the Gemara says, what about Hanukkah candles? And he says, no, he kind of leaves it as a question, other Rishonim try and answer it. The thing about Hanukkah, which is why it's different, is that it's not scriptural. There was no book in Tanakh. There were books that they tried to put in Tanakh for Hanukkah, but they didn't make it in. Okay, so the point is here that we're dealing with this issue, how to read this Gemara. If what I'm saying is correct, either way, the Gemara is saying something significant about Esther. If what I'm saying is correct, that we're saying something extremely significant about Esther, maybe we're saying something a little bit less significant if we read it the other ways. But either way, Esther is significant. Let's take that. Taking that as it is, let's look at the next source. Source number two.
Actually, the Seifa is really...
Yeah.
Supporting your...
Yeah. Right, which is where I was coming from. But we already spent too long on the source, so I want to move on. So the source number two is another Gemara from Masechet Megillah. Shalcha lahem Esther lachachamim. Esther sent to the Chachamim. Now, when we were doing the Zionism Shirim, we were actually talking historically about how much sense this made. There was the original, if we have the dates correct, as we originally said it, the original decree after the Battle of Opis, where Cyrus the Great, Koresh, was given permission, gave the Jewish people permission to go back to Eretz Yisrael. So that happened at 539 BCE, if we have the dates correct. The Purim story, it didn't really happen for another 50, 60 years later. Now what we're left with here is a population of the Jewish people, a major population in a major center of the Persian Empire that hadn't gone. So Shalchalahem Esrela Chachamim actually historically makes sense, because the Anshe Knesset HaGadola were already setting up shop in Yerushalayim, and Esther and Mordechai were still in Persia, and this whole episode was taking place. So Shalchalahem Esrela Chachamim means that after it's all taken place, and now Esther is looking retrospectively back, holding this Megillah of holding this account of the story that they experienced. She's now sending word to the Anshe Knesset HaGadola, which is now the center of Torah Judaism, and saying the following: Shalcha lahem Esther lechachamim, kitvuni ledorot. Please write me for posterity. All right. Now, most of the Rishonim are going to understand this request to be what? What's she asking for? Yeah, to include what in Tanakh? Megillat Esther. Kitvuni ledorot means we have this account of the Purim story. Please include this story in Tanakh. Shalchula, they sent back to Queen Esther. Hallo katafti lecha shlishim. Shlishim milorvim. Alright, we won't get into this drasha right now, but basically what it's referring to is the three times mentioned in Tanakh about the mitzvah of Mechiyat Amalek. Zechira and Mechiyat Amalek. That we have a mitzvah to remember and to destroy the Zera of Amalek. And the understanding Esther as part and parcel, the story of Esther as part and parcel with this fight to wipe out the Zera of Amalek is part of how we understand the holiday. It's how Chazal understood it. So since we already have three mentions of Amalek, we don't need to do a fourth. So we don't want to include it. Okay, so there's a hesitance. Chazal were hesitating, the Anshe Knesset HaGadola were hesitating to include Megillat Esther into the Tanakh. Ad shematzulo mikra katuv b'Torah, until they found a pasuk that justified the inclusion. Ktov zot zikaron b'sefer. All right, you should write this as a remembrance in a book, and then the Gemara darshins the sefer. Ktov zot mashe katuv kan uve mishne Torah. You should write what is written here and in Sefer Dvarim. All right, we're talking about Sefer Shemot, after the Siyam Yitzrayim, we're talking about Parshat B'Shalach, as Bnei Yisrael are immediately after Kriyat Yamsuf are attacked by Amalek. That's where this comes. So you should write it here, and you should write it again in Mishneh Torah, which is in Sefer Dvarim. And Zikaron, Mashikatu B'Nevi'im. You should write, again, what is written in the Nevi'im, B'Sefer, Mashikatu B'Megillah. You should write again what was written in the Megillah. So basically, Chazal are saying, because we have this justification of Zechirat Amalek, and we can add it an additional time, that is our justification for including Megillat Esther. Okay. Now, why? All right, so on the surface, the reason why we're not including Megillat Esther is because the only justification to do so is Amalek. So what is that telling us about Megillat Esther? What do we always learn? What's the most unique feature about Megillat Esther that everybody always knows about? That makes it stand alone from any other book in Tanakh? God is completely absent. Now we all learn from when we're children about all of the ways in which we we're taught that God is really behind the scenes. But on the surface, there is no God in Megillat Esther. The only justification, right, according to Chazal, that Megillat Esther could be included in Tanakh was its inclusion in the entire Parsha, the entire discussion of Zechira and Mechiyat Amalek. That's the only way that we could justify including it. What is the implication of that statement? Is there any other reason to include it? Right? The only way that we're going to include it is because of Amalek. That means that is there any other good reason? If there was another good reason, we wouldn't need to be discussing this back and forth about Amalek. There is this drasha, there's not this drasha, there is this opportunity, there is this mentioning. If that was all the case, then we wouldn't need to have these discussions. But the fact that there isn't means that it doesn't really have that potential to be in Tanakh. Now that's telling us something very significant about Megillat Esther. Right? It's telling us that despite all the things that we learn, on all of the midrashim, and all of the balayla hu nadadashinat hamelach, Achashverosh couldn't wake up because because HaKadosh Baruch Hu made him, and Haman said in his heart, that the way that the Megillah records his thoughts, and the only way that we know that Megillah records his thoughts is because there was Nevuah involved. All of those things that we learn in lots of places, Chazal even teach them, all of them don't justify, all of that divinity that we impose, that we see behind the scenes in Tanakh, doesn't justify its inclusion. If that's the case, then we are talking about something very significant about Megillat Esther. Why was it not included in the Dead Sea Scrolls? The simplest understanding is that these were a zealot group of people who served God with every fiber of their being. And without God being mentioned in Megillat Esther, it couldn't be included in Tanakh. Chazal seemed to have been on that train, understood that it's God's, you know, for whatever reason, seemingly this one, I would guess, God's absence in Megillat Esther does not allow for its inclusion in Tanakh, except for this Amalek factor. So that is interesting and fascinating, except for the following. Okay, so we have basically two perspectives. On the one hand, we have this idea that possibly Megillat Esther is more significant than anything. On the other hand, we have this possibility that if not for this technical inclusion of Amalek, it really wouldn't belong in Tanakh.
But, so, at the end of Megillah, we do Kimo Kibbo. We have all this drasha that this is Makal Kibbo,
right.
Omahu Samayim, again.
Right.
That doesn't
rate at all. It does not rate at all. Look at source number one. Here's the thing. I mean, with a lot of the questionable books in Tanakh, we have this dichotomy. On the one hand, it is the least eligible book in Tanakh, but on the other hand, it's not only eligible; it is the best. Right, and that's how. When things are nuanced and complicated, like nobody's going to ever say Sefer Shemos doesn't belong in Tanakh, right? Sefer Shemos, which actually describes Mamad Har Sinai, is there's no discussion about that. But when we get to Megillah Shir Hashirim, right? When we get to Shir Hashirim, which is we can all understand when you read through Shir Hashirim, on the surface it could be the least appropriate thing in the world to belong in the canon of Tanakh. But on the other hand, Rabbi Akiva still said that it was Kodesh HaKodeshim, not just belonging in Tanakh, but the most holy, the most sanctified of all books of Tanakh. What I'm presenting here is the fact that this dichotomy exists with Megillat Esther as well. On the one hand, you could have Chazal, who seem to say that it possibly even is on the same level as the Chamisha Chumshei Torah. But on the other hand, there's very little justification for including it. Sorry? So the point is, Jerry, is that you can even see in Chazal, so often, we make this comment, we make this statement about how Chazal are of the opinion that X, Y, Z. Where we lose sight of the fact that Chazal was not a person, it wasn't even one rabbinic entity. It was a collection of opinions and thoughts that existed over five centuries. So you can't just say that this was a clear issue. And I think that when you're seeing conflicting themes in Chazal, it's reflecting the fact that this is a complicated thing that they were struggling with. We mentioned last week, right? This is another, I think, another good example. We mentioned last week, in passing, the allowance of Rabban Gamliel to study Chachma Yevanit, study Greek wisdom, right? And I pointed out then, anybody who tells you that Chazal unquestionably, unreservedly endorsed the intense study of Greek wisdom is being extremely disingenuous, because it's a complicated topic in which in many places it is acknowledged as a positive thing, but in many places it is acknowledged as you're warned against it being as bad a thing as you could possibly do. There are lots of these things, and that's really all I'm trying to say, is that it's a complicated issue in Tanakh, and we can have both sides of this issue. Okay, so I think this is actually typified by source number three. Source number three is a Rambam. The Rambam is getting what he's saying from a Yerushalmi, but I think the Rambam says it a little bit more strongly. So I'd like to include it here. Number three, Kol Sifrei Hanaviim, the Kol HaKtuvim. This is actually the last comment the Rambam makes about Hilchos Megillah. The Rambam puts Hilchos Megillah and Chanukah together, and it's four prakim, four chapters. The first two are Megillah, and the second two are Chanukah. The last halacha in Perek Bet, which is his last halacha about Megillah, he says the following: Kol Sifrei Hanaviim, the Kol HaKtuvim. Atidim libatel limot haMashiach. Eventually, all Sifrei HaNeviim are going to be libatel. What does that mean? Nullified, canceled. I don't know. Chutz Megillat Esther. The only example, the only book of Ketuvim, the only book of Neviim and Ketuvim that is going to last is Megillat Esther. Harehi kayemet kachamishah chumshei Torah ukihilchot shel Torah shabal peh she'ina b'teilin le'olam. The Rambam is actually saying, and again, the Rambam's not making this up, this is Yerushalmi, but the Rambam is cutting and pasting this Yerushalmi that says that all scriptures are going to be nullified, canceled, gone, to some degree, b'yimot HaMashiach. Except for Megillat Esther, which is going to have this lasting effect, the same way that Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh does. So basically, we're not going to be learning Yechezkel and Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu and Daniel and Ezra anymore when it comes to Yimot HaMashiach, but we still will be reading Esther because it's important. Why? And even though all mentioning of tragedy and the pitfalls of our history are going to be gone in the times of Yimot HaMashiach, the days of Purim, which seemingly would fit the bill of a time in our history, which was a time of tzara, a time of great sorrow, those are not going to be batel. Shne'emar, v'imeya purim ha'ela lo ya'avru mitoch ha'yodim zichram lo yasuk mizaram. That the days of Purim are going to be eternal, they're going to live as a memory and never perish from the descendants of the Jewish people.
So nothing is mentioned in the Hamishach Moshech Torah.
Good question. There's actually another Gemara in Megillah that actually asks the question, Esther mina Torah mina lam. Where is it that we know that Esther is written in the Torah?
Yeah.
None of that is literal, because it's not. I mean, we can acknowledge that there's Nevuah that understood that the story of Megillat Esther was going to happen, even all of those centuries beforehand in the time of the Chemishah Chumshei Torah. But there's no explicit mention of it anywhere. The point that this is making is a very strange one. And the reason why I put it in the Rambam is because it is very uncharacteristic of the Rambam to put such a cryptic statement of Chazal in the Mishnah Torah and to not explain it. What does it mean, Atidin Libatel Kol Sefrei Nevi'im? I don't know what that means. I think that the Rambam probably had a good idea about what that means, but for whatever reason, the Rambam going completely, very uncharacteristically chose not to explain what he thinks that means. Right? The Rambam doesn't put cryptic, strange, ambiguous Mamare Chazal in the Mishnah Torah and leave them for us to figure it out. The one thing that is abundantly clear, what do you think? Right? I don't know what Atidin Libatel means. I don't know what it means that Esther is going to be, Chai V'Kayim. What is the one thing that you can't escape from this Mamar Chazal that the Rambam put in? The one takeaway, even if you don't know what Atidin Libatel means.
That Esther's different.
That Esther is qualitatively different from every other book in Tanakh. Okay, and I wanted to close with this. As complicated as this issue is, as much as the fact that Chazal unquestionably debated it, as much as they're wondering, and there's another, I could have put another half a dozen Mamar Chazal easily that discuss this issue of the place of Esther. But the very fact that the Rambam is choosing to make this statement, first of all, I think, is indicating to you that there might be some question as to Esther's status. But not only that, but the Rambam is very much siding with source number one here, endorsing this idea, again, cutting and pasting it from the Yerushalmi, even if it's a cryptic, making the point that Esther is qualitatively different than all other book in Tanakh. Now, we're going to go through this year, and not next week, but the following week, we're going to go through some of Megillat Esther. I want to read through as much as we can. I want to leave with the question of why. Why that is. And I'd like to close, hopefully, at the end of the next year, with at least what I think is a running theory as to why the Rambam took this so seriously. Again, the Rambam, this is the last comment that the Rambam made about Megillah. And the fact that he does make this comment, I think, is extremely significant. Okay, so what I was originally going to do was to go through, I was going to start with Perek Tet, and see what exactly the context of this drusha that the Rambam gives is. But I think that we'll save that for the end. And let's just jump right in. I want to use the remaining time that we have today just reading it through. Let's go through as much of Esther as we can. We'll point out as much as we can with everything. And of course, I insist that everybody share with me what your thoughts as we're going through it. And we'll see if we can come up with a theme. If there's a lot of questions that we can be asking. This is the one that I'd like to stick with you as we're running through Esther. Why is it that Esther is so qualitatively different? Now, on the surface, the reasons that it's different, we know. God's name isn't mentioned. It's outside of Eretz Yisrael. It's the other thing that the Gemara says explicitly. But aside from that, those are not things that make it unique. I mean, they make it unique, but it's not things that make it so significant. Or if those do make it significant, we have to figure out why. So what is it about Esther? Why is it so significant? Let's see if we can come up with a running theory. Okay. Starting off, Pasuk Aleph, we're in source number 5 and on source 2. Vayhi bimei Achashverosh. In the days of Achashverosh. Hu Achashverosh hamolech mahodu v'yad kush. Sheva v'yisrim miyam dina. By the way, I brought this. I have, this is like a sampling in my library of books I have on Esther. I brought them to show you. There's a lot written here. If anybody wants to borrow something, by the way, you're more than welcome to. I've read through a whole bunch of this stuff, and we're talking about 10 Prakim in Tanakh, and it has captured the hearts and minds of our Parshanim for time immemorial. So recognize that there's a lot of different ways to approach this Megillah, a lot of intrigue and interest in the every turn of phrase. So in the days of Achashverosh, who was this person? Achashverosh hamolech mahod v'yad kush sheva v'esrim me'amdina. Okay, so I think opening up, I think the indication clearly is that we're dealing with a retrospective analysis of what's happened. Right? Why the need to identify this person? If the Mechaber of Megillat Esther was writing in real time, right? If I was going to be writing a book right now about the presidency of Barack Obama, I would say, you know, in the year 2016, President Barack Obama said the following. The fact that we are talking about how it was the days of the Melech Achashverosh, who happened to be the Achashverosh who reigned from Mahod V'yad Kush, Sheva V'esrim Me'amdina, in 127 provinces, the fact that that happened to have been the case seems to indicate that either there were multiple Achashveroshes, right, or that there was maybe one Achashverosh, but we're at a time where he was no longer in power. So we feel the need to identify him. In those days, when Achashverosh was sitting on his throne in Shushan HaBira, all right. Again, now we're trying to frame the historical period. In the year 3 of Panav. So in these days, during this time, in the reign of this such and such king, in the third year of his reign, he did a mishteh lechol sarav yavadav. He did a party for all of his servants. Chel parasu madaya partuim v'sarayam yidot lefanav. Okay, so this is a lot of these words are actually uniquely Persian words. There's an important thing about Megillat Esther, is that it's clearly being written by a narrator that happened. You know, I'm arguing retrospectively, but the fact that we know this because all the discussions that happen in Megillat Esther are happening in what language? When we're reading them through. Achashverosh is talking to Esther. He's talking to her in Hebrew. Right? Was Achashverosh speaking in Hebrew?
No.
What language is Achashverosh likely speaking? Some ancient version of Farsi. Right? So I actually grew up with many neighbors and friends who spoke Persian in my in Roslyn. I didn't really realize this until later, but I don't think any of the words any of the Persian words that come up in Megillat Esther actually are used in modern day Farsi. Afal pichen, a precursor to modern day Farsi, there are endless examples in Megillat Esther of Persian words that found their way into Megillat Esther. So there's a couple examples already over here. Apartamim is a Persian word. There are one of the many approaches to the literary analysis of Megillat Esther is to go through this stuff and see where they were using Persian words and why the need to use this word and not that word and why couldn't they have used Hebrew when it was being read in Hebrew. So the simple answer to all of this stuff is that who is this Megillah written for?
Locals.
Who?
The locals.
The locals, yeah. It was a short period of history, but it was a history being written for the members of the Jewish community. Now, it would be the equivalent of me saying, you know, of me writing it today, and even if I was writing in English, if anybody's ever read through the Tshuvot of Rav Moshe Feinstein, and you can't go half a tshuva without him transliterating a word that he's reading into English. So he'll be talking about a tshuva about the halachot of a refrigerator on Shabbos, and he'll use the word mekarer, and then he'll write mekarer, and then parentheses refrigerator in Hebrew. Right, so that would be if we were writing a Megillat Esther today, that would be, you know, Vaihibi Mei, the frigidaire mekarerim, who ha refrigerator. So a lot of the words that are in Esther are reflective of this. Apartamim v'asrayam dinot lefanav. Baharot ares from posik dalet. Baharotot osher kvod malchuto v'et yikaret tveret gulato yamim rabim shimonim u'meyat yom. So what was happening during this period? The purpose of this party was to show the osher kvod malchuto and yikar tiferet gulato, the wealth and the honor of his monarchy, and Yekar Tiferet Gedulato, the majesty of his greatness, Yamim Ravim Shmonim Umeyat Yom, 180 days. Okay, now, who does this? Why are we making a party, and why is the purpose of a party to show the majesty and greatness and the wealth of a king? What's the purpose of doing this? Why would somebody do that? Why would any great leader every leader in history has had a limit on their tax revenue, right? You have things that you can spend it on, and you have to make those choices. Ahasuerus chose to spend his tax revenue, chose to spend the treasury on this lavish party. And we don't need to be asking. The Megillah tells us why he's doing it. It's to show everybody the Ikar Tiferet Gulato, all right, and the Oshe Kod Malchuto. Why would a king do that?
Prove that he should be the king.
Yeah.
To show off, because the whole question is where he originally came from.
Right. So there are midrashim abound, and the midrashim and Esther are fascinating. I encourage you. Actually, one of the books I have here, Art Scroll, started a few years ago, started putting out the Midrash Rabbah in English. This is a really great opportunity to actually just go through Midrashim. If ordinarily going through Midrash is hard. So it's definitely a really good pickup if anybody's interested in preparation for Purim. The Midrashim, talk about these things. There are so many fascinating backstory details that the Midrash fills in. That Ahasuerus, who he was, and how he gained power, and how Vashti was really the royalty in town, and he chose to get into power by marrying her, and that was so. These are all the midrashim that we've been learning about all these years. They're great. The text doesn't seem to indicate that. That doesn't mean that they're wrong. It just means that the text doesn't seem to emphasize that. The text is not telling us that Ahasuerus's claim to power was dependent on his wife. The text is telling us that he was a king that needed to make all this big lavish party, and he seems to have felt the need to display his greatness, to display his honor, to display his kavod. Now, why would somebody need to do that? Or somebody who needs to, again, when you think about how much something like this costs, and you think about how this is not a wise thing to do for a king to do it. The only way we're going to assume that Ahasuerus had a reason and a rhyme behind what he was doing. So the reason that he was doing it was that he needed to show everybody his honor. The reason that you need to show everybody his honor maybe is because he had a tenuous hold on the throne. Right? Now, maybe this reason, his tenuousness was because of who he married and his claim to the throne. Maybe it was, and I think that this is really important, maybe it was because from the very first moment in Megillat Esther, we are told that there was a huge amount of intrigue, there's a huge amount of chicanery that was going on in the court of Ahasuerus. And people were out to get him. And this was something that he recognized. Okay? Does that make sense? And that's borne out in the text. How do we know? Because, in fact, there was an assassination attempt on Ahasuerus. At the very least, there's one that we know about. Alright? There's one that we know about. Who knows if there were many, many more? Now, when a king is nervous because he's worried about his hold on power, a monarchy is a very tricky thing, because when you're putting all of the power and all of the political influence in one man, all right, then especially when that one man is only achieved his rule by way of military conquest, all you need to do is get at that one guy and the whole thing falls apart. It's one of the arguments for democracy, honestly. If you have a leadership body that's made up of a huge legislature, so it's a lot harder for a foreign army to come and invade and get, 150, 200, 500 members of Congress than it is to get one man. So the whole system doesn't crumble. The whole system of government doesn't crumble if you get at this one man. And that's not what I was getting at all. But, all right, if we want, I don't mind, but we'll wait for a time in which that actually is relevant. So the point is that for a king, in this system of government, all right? Oh, by the way, and I'll make different plugs here and there of some of these books. This is a magnificent, Yoram Chazoni's book on Esther. It's called The Dawn. This is, the whole point of Chazoni's discussion is political messages in Megillat Esther. So he makes points like this. What is the political structure of a monarchy? All the monarchies in the Middle Ages that were rising and falling are because of this idea. When you have an absolute monarchy and the entire system is dependent on one person, then all you need to do is get at that one person. So you have somebody who comes along and says, I want to be king, or they think that this guy is the king for incorrect reasons, so all we need to do is get at him. So there was a lot already from the get-go, and I think because of the subsequent story, in the subsequent narrative in Megillat Esther, the first thing that we are told about Ahasuerus, the first thing, absolute first thing, and I think because this is the first thing, this might be the most important thing that we need to understand throughout Megillat Esther, is that Ahasuerus was nervous about people out to get him. Okay? So that's I think important, really, really important point number one in terms of themes of Megillat Esther. So we are going through, we're up to Pasuk Vav. Churkar Pasuk, the Chelad Achud, right? So now this is a description of, back to Pasuk, but a description of how lavish this affair was. Karpasu the Chelad Achud, Bechavle Hutz, V'yargaman, all these different materials. Al Galile Chesef, Yamudi Sheish, on silver trays. Mitot Zahav Achesef, Al Yitzpat Zahav Vashesh, Vadar V'socharet. Hashkot Bechle Zahav, and they were drinking out of golden goblets. Bechelim, Bechelim, Shonim, and all these different things, which we know, of course, the Midrash says was, the Gemara says was a, were kelim that were actually taken from the Beit HaMikdash. Rav Kiyad HaMelech, everything, all of this stuff was being done in excess. Every single person could do whatever he wanted, everybody got what they wanted. Based on the, because the king was so magnanimous, the king was so generous. V'ashetiyak hadat inones, kichen yisad HaMelech al karav beitel lasot kirtzon ish v'ish. Okay, not only is the king making a lavish party, but he wanted everybody to get whatever it is that they wanted. And so why would the bullying class, or the kid in class who comes in with the big bag of candy and starts giving it out to everybody, why is he doing it?
Be popular.
Yeah. What do you think? What's Ahasuerus's? Ahasuerus is here. Now we're telling something. We're told about him. Not only that he wants to show everybody the Osher Kvod Malchuto and Yekar Tiferet Kedulato, the majesty and greatness of his power and his wealth. But we also are shown about how generous he was, his generosity. So, showing his great power, but also his general. Why is he being so generous? Because he wants to be popular. The best way to forestall any possible usurpacious attempts at his monarchy is not just to root out the problem, the few people that are problems that are making the problem, but to get it from the bottom up. To really try and get everybody to be on his side. If everybody thinks Ahasuerus is this wonderful person, then we don't need to. There are going to be fewer people that are going to be out to get him. So I think if this is the theme, if we're going to understand Ahasuerus's anxiety, which is a big part of reading, between the lines of Megillat Esther, if we're going to understand his anxiety, a big, big part of this is going to be understanding his understanding. The fact that he's going out of his way in all these different methods to try and consolidate his power and get people to like him. Okay, next part. Pasuk 10. Gam mashkiya malka asatak mishkei nashim peit hamachut asher l'melech Ahasuerus. So there was a corresponding party for women. What exactly that means is I don't think that I actually think that the Megillah doesn't really care why Vashti is making a party. I think that the Megillah, the only thing that the Megillah mentions any of this about, and if you'll notice, we don't get any details about Vashti's party. If Vashti's party was inherently significant, wouldn't you think that we would hear something along the lines of Vashtiyak Adat Inunes, or we would get we would get anything about how much gold and silver was being used, or how much materials were being used, or how generous everybody was. The only thing that we know is that Vashti was making something, some gathering also that was corresponding, that was happening at the same time, coinciding with Ahasuerus's stuff. Ahasuerus's party. All right, so we're on Pasuk Yud. Vayom Hashvi'i Ketov Lev HaMelech Vayayim. On the seventh day, when he was good and drunk, I would say. What's the other way? That's usually how we translate that. Ketov Lev HaMelech Vayayim. What's the other way to translate it? Ketov Lev HaMelech Vayayim usually understands that he was. I'll make it this way. This is now what we're about to read is the story of Ahasuerus and how everything that happened with Vashti, how things get out of hand, which of course spiral downward and how we get the Purim story to begin with. What's the other way to understand this? Ketov Lev HaMelech Bayayin doesn't literally mean that he was a shikor. We have examples in Tanakh of somebody being drunk, or at least somebody thinking somebody was drunk. What's the most famous example? Chanan Eli, right? So if we have there are so many references in every book of Tanakh, there are so many references, or I would say phraseology that's used from earlier sources. The person who was writing Megillat Esther clearly had the text of Shmuel. If he wanted to invoke an image of somebody drunk, he could be using that language. The word shikor existed in Tanakh. Why is he used the term of Ketov Lev HaMelech Bayayim? So it could be that it's synonymous, and it, you know, it really does mean that he was drunk. What's another way of saying it? What else could it mean?
Point out the health benefits of drinking water.
Maybe that's it. It could be there that, you know, point out the health benefits of alcoholic consumption. Good. Probably even for and even for the women who are having, so pregnant women probably should be drinking alcohol as well.
Would it be possible that the women were not invited to the mishnah of the melech, so that's why that Vashti made the own party?
So maybe, but what I was suggesting before is that according to the Megillah, and then again Chazal have their opinions about what Vashti's party was, and they're important. But according to the text, why Vashti made a party or why it was separate doesn't seem to matter. The only significant point that the Megillah, that the text seems to put forth here, is that Vashti wasn't there. That's it. That's all that we need to know. And the reason why that's important is because in the subsequent narrative, the fact that Vashti wasn't there has all the significance in the world. Because Vashti wasn't there, that means that she needed to be brought. And the fact that she needed to be brought allowed for her to refuse to be brought, which is what allowed the whole subsequent narrative to take place. So that why Vashti made a party isn't interesting. It doesn't interest me, at least according to the text, because the text doesn't seem to care. The only thing we need to know is that she was elsewhere. But my question is, what does Tovli v'Melech Payayim mean? I think, considering what we know about Achashverosh and what we are going to subsequently know as we read through different parts of the story, to have the image of Achashverosh as an aimless, silly, goofy drunk is very, very incorrect. It's very inaccurate. It's not inaccurate because I think that somebody who can achieve that level of power and that level of influence rarely is going to be a silly, stupid man. It's not just that. It's because I think that when you look closely at the text is actually showing Achashverosh to be a very cunning person. I don't think that any of this is the work of a drunk man. I think that the idea of him going out of his way to try and consolidate his power and increase his favorables, right? That's to use the polling term. We're in the election season. This stuff is on my mind, right? So if you want to increase his favorables and decrease his unfavorables, that's not the work of an aimless drunk man. This is the work of somebody who is shrewd and calculated and knows what he's doing. So I would argue that the better read of Ketov Lev HaMelech Payayin is not that he was a shikor, but that he was happy. Why would he be happy? Ketov Lev HaMelech Payayin. Ketov Lev means that he his heart was good, right? So he was happy. Bayayin means through all of the wine that was being poured. So what does that mean? After describing this whole big lavish feast that we would argue actually has a purpose for it.
It worked,
right? But Achashverosh is now happy because this big plan, this big plot that he had to get everybody to like him, to increase the favorables, decrease the unfavorables, and that whole big plan was working. Okay? And then, and once that's the case, then things now have, maybe are now allowed to take place a little bit differently because he was happy. So again, I encourage you to at least consider the possibility that we're dealing not with the work of a drunk person, but with the work of somebody who's happy, but also very shrewd and calculated in what he's doing. What happens? Amar lim human, bizitach harbona, biktavi avata, zeyte becharka, shivata sarisim ha-mesharatim etnei ha-melech ha-chashverosh. Okay, so these are all very Persian names, which, by the way, so are Mordechai and Esther. We'll get to that when we introduce them. But almost all of the names in, with the exception of Mordechai's lineage, almost all the names in Esther are ancient Farsi names. We'll get to Mordechai and Esther when we get there. Okay, so what happens? He says to all of these guys, we'll see, I'm not sure yet if they're who they are is significant. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Lahavi, or actually we'll make the Shivat HaSarisim HaMesharatim Et Pnei HaMelech HaKashverosh. Who were they? They were the Sarisim. Now Sarisim usually is translated as a eunuch, alright, which it often is. It's possible that this is not, that's not what it means here. It just means that they were his close advisors. And why is it that they're significant? Who were they? HaMesharatim Et Pnei HaMelech HaKashverosh. Who were advisors that saw the Pnei HaMelech? What is that telling us about HaKashverosh? That he had seven advisors that were Ro'e Pnei HaMelech. HaMesharatim Et Pnei HaMelech. This phrase comes up in a lot of different places. I think that, so it could be that he had hundreds of advisors, and these were the members of his cabinet versus, you know, the members of Congress. You know, it could be that. Or I think what is more likely is that we're getting a depiction of what the Persian court was like. Nobody was allowed in except for these people that were the Meshartim Pnei HaMelech. They were the ones who advised him actually in front of him. He had seven a council of advisors that sat in front of his throne, and these were the only people that were able to see him. So Katov Liv HaMelech Vayayin, it might be indicating to us that throughout all of this partying that's going on, Ahasuerus never really sat with the people. He never really sat with his advisors. He only had his with his servants. He only had these seven, possibly. Okay. Pasuk Yud Aleph. Lahavi, what did he tell them? He said to all these guys, Lahavi et Vashti Malka lefnei Hamelech beketem achut laharot et hamim lesarim et yofya ki tovat marehi. Okay. Now Chazal, the Medrash talks about how there he wanted her to come, you know, come naked, and that's of course, making this into a very different theme. Is that this was, and I think that falls along with the theme of Ahasuerus as the aimless drunk who was, was acting like a, with debauchery, right? He was acting like a vile, aimless drunk who wants to now look at, display his naked wife in front of everybody. I think according to, it's not only the fact that the text doesn't mention anything about that, it just has to come in her keter machut. What do you think is the, on the surface, is the possibility of why he wants Ashi to come? It's exactly the reason that it says. To what? What the reason to come is to laharot ha'amim etiofia, to come becheter machut, laharot to everybody et yofiaki tovat marahi. What's one of the ways that you show everybody about how powerful and influential you are? All right. Forgive the misogyny of this. We are dealing with 2,500 years ago. But yeah, he's showing his trophy wife. He wants to show everybody. Not only is he powerful. Not only is he generous, magnanimous. Not only is he glorified. But he's also somebody who has the richest, most beautiful wife. Yes.
But it would also fit in if she was the reason.
So, which is where Chazal are coming from, absolutely. But the text doesn't emphasize her lineage. That's why, again, Bechetr Machut is where Chazal are coming from. They're saying her crown was her crown, not his crown, because she was really the one who was coming from the great lineage. 100% that, and Chazal, don't 90% of Chazal are meticulously following the text, and they're picking up on text. Don't let anybody ever tell you the Chazal were not Pashtunim, because they absolutely were. They will take a nuance in the text and go with it, but they're always pointing something out. That's where they're coming from. Again, strictly in the Pshat level, I think that what it's pointing out here is not her lineage, but her beauty and her status. Not only is Ahasuerus have this trophy wife, but he also has the ability to take any woman he wants, who now he found his most beautiful woman in the kingdom, and put the Keter Malchut on her. All right, which by the way, enough of the references. Jeez, I think that Ahasuerus was a lot smarter and a lot, a lot wiser. And I'm not to use Governor Romney's point. I don't think that we could say about him that he was very, very, very not smart. I don't think that we could say that about Ahasuerus. I'm making the argument that he was very, very, very smart. The point here is that he knows what speaks to the people. So it could be a couple of things. Maybe it's because she had royal lineage. Maybe it wasn't because she had royal lineage, and he just wanted to show everybody how beautiful his wife was. I would say one more on top of that. He was showing everybody, assuming that she was an average Sally from the street, or maybe from a powerful family. He was showing everybody the ability that he has with the Keter Malchut to vault somebody into great power and great influence. Okay? So he has his trophy wife, he has the ability to show some, and the reason why I think that, by the way, is because that's exactly what happens later. In the subsequent narrative, he then has the ability to just completely dispose of who, until now, was the most beautiful woman in the kingdom, and put a new crown on somebody else. Right? Ahasuerus is just trying to show how generous and kind and benevolent of a king he is. He's also trying to show how powerful and glorious of a king he was. He also is just showing just how much he exerts influence over everybody. Okay, so that's, I think, is at least on the surface what might be going on here. But what happens? All right, the simple plan that he's got going on here is interrupted. Okay, so why is Vashti refusing to go? Does the pasuk tell us?
No.
Probably not. It probably doesn't tell us. The only thing that it does tell us is what? All right? It doesn't say anything about mixed dancing. No. the only thing that it is telling us. Alright, Vatima'in Hamakabashi Labobit Varamelech. What's the next words? Sherbiyad Asarisim. Okay. The only possible read in this Pasuk as to why she wasn't going. Now I'm not saying that this is clear, because it could just be a repetition of what the king was or, the king's orders. But the only possible reading of this order, of this refusal, is that, at least in, if you want to say that the pasuk is telling us why she was, didn't want to go, the only possible read is that she didn't want to go bi'aras harisim. She didn't want to be ferreted to the king by the servants. Now, why would somebody not want to do that?
Disrespect.
Yeah, it's disrespect. All right. Think of the, you know, think of the queen. The queen is somebody who has now been vaulted to this great level of influence, a great level of power. Who is the king to come along and send his servants to come get me? If the king wants me, he should come himself. Okay. Now, if you're Ahasuerus, all right, and if you're the king who is now trying to exert influence and power and demonstrate how you know how just how powerful you are, then how can you react to this? Like, what's the reaction? Again, I'm trying to, I want to just emphasize the fact that we should be looking to read this as, in a way other than he was an aimless drunk. So what's next? That's the end of your bet. He was furious about it. Vashti's refusal to come. This is a perfect example of what I'm saying about Ahasuerus being calculated in what he's doing. If you're an aimless drunk, right? If you're a silly buffoon who is just acting on a whim, then what do you do when your wife, who's trying to exert some level of influence, or is trying to say that you should have come yourself? What do you do when she does that? You act spontaneously. You act, you know, on a whim. If you are the aimless drunk, but if this is all about a calculated strategy of exerting power and consolidating, raising the favorables, lowering the unfavorables, then how to deal with this is a very thorny question. On the one hand, he could execute her immediately, but then what's going to happen? I mean, and then it goes on to say what's going to happen. So he has these choices: he can execute her immediately, he can ignore it, or he could do something in between, punish her in some kind of way. So that all comes out as the, you know, in the subsequent psukim. Right, and it's even telling us what his usual strategy was. Right, again, try and see this as not the work of a buffoon. He was a calculated person who decided things based on what he was, you know, his usual method was to decide things with after discussing it with his advisors. Not only advisors, but the ones who were closest to him. So again, think of this as his council of advisors, who were the only ones that were ro'ei pnei ha-melech. Most people didn't see the king. Okay, maybe he didn't see the king because he wanted to emphasize how powerful he was and untouchable he was. What's another reason that he wouldn't let anybody see him? Yeah, if he's really paranoid, he's really anxious about there being a plot out to get him. Then the fact that there was a select few people that he trusted and only allowed those people to be the ones that saw him, then that, you know, again, another possible indication that this is the character of Ahasuerus that we're talking about. So what did he say? So he gets to them, we're in Pasuk Tetvav, Kadak Mala Sot Malkavashti, Alasher Lo Asata et Ma'amar Hamelach Ahasuerus Biyad Hasarisim. And again, third time that we have this, what was Vashti doing? She refused to listen to the Dvar HaMelech Biyad Hasarisim. So if we're looking for an indication that what Vashti's consternation here was about, not just doing what Ahasuerus wanted, but to do it beyond the Sarisim, maybe that's the case. Now, take Vashti's perspective. If we're right, that the reason that she refused was the beyond the Sarisim, what do you think would have been her attitude about the monarchy? Ahasuerus is clearly in charge. Who, under Ahasuerus, who comes next?
Shia.
So Vashti might have been thinking that the only person that I have to answer to is the king. Now the king's idea here is, no, that's incorrect. You are my wife, and you are here to do my bidding, but you're a subject like everybody else. You're here to serve my purpose. Right now, my sarisim are more important to me. I'm trying to figure out, I'm trying to calculate, I'm trying to devise how to consolidate my power and make sure that everybody likes me. How to make sure my monarchy sticks around. You don't serve a purpose in that. So if that's the case, my main goal, my main function is the planning that the Sarisim bring me. So if that's the case, then again, we're dealing with this character of Ahasuerus who had this calculated approach to everything. A perfect proof to all this is that the queen didn't have any real influence in the monarchy is what happens later in the story. With Esther, what happens with Esther? If the queen, yeah, if the queen really was as powerful as Vashti seems to indicate that the queen should be, then Esther, first of all, I don't think would be so worried about being executed like any other person that was that walked into the king randomly, and I don't think that she would be so concerned that the king wouldn't listen to her. She needs to go through this intensely devised strategy about how to make sure that when she pops the big question to Ahasuerus, he's going to listen. If that was the case. If it was the case, like Vashti seems to be showing, that the queen exerts influence, then there would never be any reason to think that.
Yeah, but this was a cautionary tale. What happens to Vashti?
Uh-huh. So you're saying that Esther was only reacting
yes.
because of...
Hey.
Okay. So it could be. So it could be that this was the moment in time in which the laws of the queen in ancient Persia were set. Maybe. All right. Either way, I think there was a debate between... We're talking great debates in Jewish history. There was a debate, clearly, between Vashti and... Ahasuerus as to the role of the female monarch.
I think you say that where she came from originally, that he got to where he did based on her. She said, "Hey, I'm your equal. I got you right here, and therefore."
Okay, so I 100% agree with you. Remember, but I'll say this every time we mention Chazal's here because it's so true. Chazal are picking up on the nuances. I think Chazal are picking up on these very points that we're making, which is where their read of this, of using this tradition of Vashti being descending from royalty, and that's how Ahasuerus got his royal status from, using that to interpret all of these things. 100%. The one piece that we always need to say as a caveat here is that. There's indications to the contrary in the text, but also the text doesn't mention anything about that. And if it was an important point, it might be, right? But the fact that the text doesn't mention it, I always make this point, it doesn't mean it didn't happen. It means that what I'm interested in when I say textual reading is, why does the text go out of its way to present things the way presented? I didn't end up speaking to Shabbos, but were I to have spoken, I was discussing this with Rav Hochman yesterday, were I to have spoken, I was really interested in how the Torah presents the Arba'im Yom Arba'im Laila of Moshe Rabbeinu. He goes up, and the way according to the Torah presents it, the only thing that he received while he was up there is Truma Tetzaveh and the beginning of Kitisa. Right? The Chazal understand that we very much acknowledge that Moshe got Kol HaTorah Kula up there. But if that's the case, we need to understand why Chazal are wrong, because that's not true, why the text is going out of its way to present the narrative to us in a way that the only thing that was happening, the only thing that was going up while he was going on while he was there, was 2.5 parshiot. Okay, so let's see if we can finish. Well, we're not going to finish up Perek Aleph, but let's do a little bit more, and then we'll call it a day, and then I will be a little bit more selective over which part of the Megillah that we're going to read next time. Okay, so how do we? Let's just try and get the beginnings of the plan. So he's trying to figure out what to do with Vashti who rebelled. All right, Mimuchan comes along. Chazal say that this is actually Haman. It's actually, according to the Pshat, hard to swallow. Not just because he has a different name, but because he is acting a little bit differently than Haman eventually does. There's no self-interest here. There's no there's very little planning that has anything to do with Mimuchan himself. He actually seems to be much more of a devoted servant who's trying to do what's best for the king. But again, Chazal are not coming out of nowhere. We'll have a discussion for another time. Vayomer Mimuchan lifnei Amelech v'Asarim. לא על המלך לבדו אבל אתה ושתי המלכה כי על כל הסרים ועל כל העמים אשר מלכו מדינות המלך אחשוורוש. It wasn't just you that Vashti was rebelling against. It was against everybody. This is not a fight for the honor of the monarchy. This is a fight for misogyny. We need to be defending the role of men and the role of women in the home. And if you don't do the right thing here, it's not just the honor of the monarchy that's being threatened. It's the role of men and women for all time. Okay? This does seem repugnant to me, just in case anybody thinks that I guess, how many disclaimers can I give? All right, Kol Yitzah, what's going to happen if this gets out? Yud Zayin. Ki Yitzay Dvar HaMalkah HaKol HaNashim Yalav Zot Ba'alayim B'inehen. All right, what's going to happen? His word is going to ring forth that all of the wives are going to be able to be mevazeh, they're going to be able to embarrass, they're going to be able to disgrace their husbands in front of their faces. V'omram HaMalach HaKashverosh. By the way, the people who read Esther as a book of feminism, as of the strong female leader, I think Vashti is probably equally significant of a character to read this. I'm not saying this critically at all. If you're going to read this as Esther, and I think that there's a good argument to make that Esther is a book that's there to talk to us about the power and potential of a woman in leadership role, I think Vashti is a really she's a tragic figure because she's somebody that dies standing her ground. But this is, she dies for a cause. So what happens? What's everybody's going to be talking about this story? Right? By the way, how is the story going to get out? This is an important point. Maybe we'll close with this. If the only people that we're talking about, let's say, according to the Pshat of the Megillah, there were these seven Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech that were in his inner chamber. These were the people that that he asked Vashti to come and show her, her beauty and her crown and her, the power of Ahasuerus for. If these were the only people there, how is it ever going to get out? What is the under the surface acknowledgement here?
Vashti
could say it, right? That's one possibility. But he at no point here does he say that you shouldn't kill her. He's just saying, he's setting up here the importance about why you need to deal with this properly. Right? We don't know what happens to Vashti in the end.
So I would imagine he will come in there and then send her out in front of everybody else.
Yeah, but he also wanted, the plan that he had was to show her just in front of... could be that he wanted to parade her around in a little cart to everybody on a display case for everybody in the kingdom. Or what I think is more likely, considering the scene that is being set up here of the Persian court, he wanted to show the upper leadership of Parasa Madai who this beautiful queen was, and then everybody was going to go home and tell the story of the party. You wouldn't believe the gorgeous queen that Ahasuerus has. This Vashti, she's a 10. Right? I think that's probably a closer, read of strictly the text. But what's the underlying assumption of Memuchan's point here? Ahasuerus is trying to consolidate power. Let's say he said to the 7, 10, 15, 20 people that were in the room, all right, on your life, no, this word of this can never get out anywhere. Let's say he even kills Vashti to make sure that it never gets out anywhere. So what's the underlying assumption? Is that even if he were to say that, even if he were to guarantee that, and Muhammad is saying there is absolutely no way that this story won't get out. If it was limited to a few number of people, what does that indicate?
His closest advisors would squeal.
Exactly. So I think that the indication here is that even Ahasuerus' closest advisors, he couldn't trust. These were the people that were Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech, Yoshim Rishonah B'Malchut. Afal Pichein, these are people that he still couldn't trust. Now, as we're obviously not going to be able to read through, if we had 10 shirim, we could get through all the Megillat Esther properly. But we're not going to be able to get through everything. I'm going to select a section for the next shiur. But I encourage everybody, as we study through Megillat Esther in the next weeks, and certainly Leil Purim, when we're following along, of course, not word for word, don't make sure you don't miss anything. Think about this. Think about the character of Ahasuerus, which is what Perek Aleph is setting up, as somebody not who is an aimless drunk, but somebody who actually is taking a calculated... calculated risks, but also very, very nuanced in his approach to try and maintain his power, and as a result, is extremely anxious throughout the entire story. And if we take that, then we can, I think, explain his actions and the reactions to his actions a lot better. Shkoach, thanks so much, everybody.